From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book that explores American paranoia, the journalist Jesse Walker says a lot of conspiracy theories came out of the era of the Civil War. It was a paranoid time, he writes, but in America, it is always a paranoid time. Walker says if you think these outlandish theories you've heard about 9/11 being an inside job or the moon landing being faked or a feature of the fringe of society, you're wrong. Walker says conspiracy theories have always been with us as a country, and we are all capable of paranoid thinking. Today in the program, Walker will join us to explain how conspiracy theories exist on all sides of the political spectrum, how they happen in good times and in bad, and whether they're true or not, he says, they say something about us. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Jesse Walker says he hopes that those who read his new book exploring American conspiracy theories will come away with this very clear point, that virtually everyone is capable of paranoid thinking. Everyone, he says, him included, you too, the broad-minded, the skeptical, even the founding fathers were given to paranoia from time to time. The book does not go about debunking certain conspiracies or trying to prove them true, and he acknowledges there are conspiracies that are true, but whether they're true or not, or crazy or not, a conspiracy story, he writes, says something true about the anxieties and experiences of the people who believe and repeat them. Today in the program, Jesse Walker is joining us. We've been thinking about conspiracy stories lately because of the anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy this week, so we'll talk about that, but there are a lot of conspiracies to talk about today, and why they exist, how we believe them. 801-585-WEST is the number if you'd like to join the conversation today. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jesse Walker is the managing editor at Reason Magazine. The United States of Paranoia is his second book. His first was Rebels on the Air, which looked at alternative radio in America. And he's joining us from NPR member station WYPR in Baltimore today. And Jesse Walker, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me on.
Well, I wanted to start with something you say early on in the book is that your book is about American demons. Some mm-hmm. of the demons are imaginary, but all of them, you say, have truths to tell us. What do you mean by that, just generally?
Well, it gets to what you were saying earlier, that if a story catches on, whether or not it's true or, you know, false or partially true, the very fact that people are willing to believe it says that it speaks to their experiences in a way, and or at least speaks to their anxieties. And I think that using a conspiracy theories as a lens on the past just opens up a whole new way of looking at American history. It's a history of the things that we've been afraid of, and that in turn becomes a sort of distorted mirror history of our culture.
Yeah. When did you start thinking that you wanted to, that there was so much here that you wanted to, you know, explore it as a book?
It's a good question. It's one of those things that sort of organically evolved out of writing I'd been doing for ages. There's actually quotes in this book that come from a work I did for a magazine article way back in 1995.
Wow.
I retained the quotes and used them here. I think it was sometime around 2007 or 8 that I started working on a potential book proposal. But even then, it was pretty different from what I wound up ultimately writing.
I wonder, is there kind of a bit of a contrarian impulse in this book? Because we'll talk about this kind of in detail, but I think you probably like the idea of saying, look, this is not, if you think this is just something that is for the fringes of society or for the right, the political right, you're wrong. I mean, this is an idea that you really work through in the book that doesn't matter where on the political spectrum you lie. There are these theories everywhere.
Yeah, and often they're not even sort of consciously seen as political at the time. I mean, pretty much any, and I've written a fair amount about moral panics over the years.
Yeah.
And often at the core of a moral panic, are these sort of moments when suddenly the media and the politicians are all focused on an alleged threat, you know, to the culture and the body politic, our children or what have you. There's a conspiracy theory at the core of it that's often not labeled as a conspiracy theory because we're all just sort of swimming in it. We all sort of take it, most of the people writing about it or speaking about it take it for granted. And then some years afterwards, you might look back and say, you know, to give a particularly egregious example, that when we were all going on about satanic cults in the 1980s, maybe there was a bit of a nutty conspiracy theory there. But it isn't always identified as such at the time. And part of what I guess drove me to write this book was seeing, on the one hand, seeing the same people who talk about conspiracy theories as though they're just some fringy thing, partaking lustily of this sort of conspiratorial talk during one of these panic episodes.
I wanted to get this out of the way, and I mentioned it in the introduction. Neither your book nor the show today is about debunking any one of these theories. That's not what you're really interested in. But I wonder if as you've been doing interviews throughout and talking to people about it, if that's the sort of knee-jerk impression that you're going to finally put to rest this idea about JFK or the moon landing or stuff like that.
Sure. There's people who are assuming, you know, that a book about conspiracy theories is going to be like some other book about conspiracy theories that they've read or seen at some point. A lot of them are debunking books. There's also the opposite, books that sort of list all the conspiracy theories that the author thinks are likely true. Now, there are points in this book, especially when I'm writing about something that's several hundred years ago and people aren't familiar with the evidence, that I'll say, well, either we know it's false because of this, or we don't know if it's true or false because the evidence is scanty. And there are moments when I say, you know, here's a conspiracy that really happened. And it's important to work those into the story because those in turn, I mean, I'm speaking of things like, you know, the 1970s revelations about the CIA and the FBI. When those came out, that affected in turn what other sorts of conspiracies people were able and willing to imagine. So it's an important part of the story. But I try not to make either one of those the focus. It's a book about the history of American folklore, really, or conspiracy folklore. And that's got to be my focus.
You say, this is interesting, that it's even possible to be paranoid about paranoia or paranoids. And to illustrate this, you tell the story early on about the War of the Worlds. It was that radio broadcast in 1938. Of course, all of us have heard about it. And we all have... We just had the anniversary. But all of us have kind of one version of that story. But most of us kind of misread it. And I wanted you to talk about it because you talk about this as kind of a parable of hysteria, but not the kind that we usually think about.
Yeah, well, in popular memory, I mean, lots of people listened to this radio show. They heard this science fiction play, which for those of you who haven't heard it, is done in this style, or at least the first half of the play is done in this style of a program being interrupted by ever more frantic bulletins about these things going on in New Jersey. It's brilliantly done. Yeah. And so in popular memory, lots of people believe this was real. There was panic in the streets, people almost committing suicide, you know, getting their guns, you know, fleeing for the heartland and so on. In fact, and first of all, not many people were listening. It wasn't a highly rated program. But beyond that, there's no real sign. I mean, and the initial study that seemed to show that millions of people were taken in, the numbers in that study have been pretty much debunked. In general, there's no sign that there are more people who believe this than the number of people today who see an Onion story on Facebook and assume it's true.
Right.
It was really heavily hyped because of, well, number one reason is that it was on radio and newspapers saw radio as a competitor. So this was a nice thing to point to. But even beyond that, though, it spoke to these anxieties that, you know, the people are prone to panicking. And beyond that, that someone using a powerful new medium like radio could sort of manipulate them from afar. Mm. And it spoke to this kind of elite panic about, you know, the ordinary people as this sort of easily misled mob. The quote I have from Walter Lippmann was, the crowds that drift with all the winds that blow are caught up at last in the great hurricanes, masses without roots. are the chaos in which the new Caesars are born. And this spoke, obviously, in 1938. You can see what was on people's mind,
yeah.
Right? So in a way, the irony is this story that people remember as lots of people, panicking over something that isn't true, itself became a fable that isn't true, that people believe and has driven a lot of sort of panicked responses.
Why do you think it is that it's appealing to some of us that the streets would be flooded with these panicked, gullible, idiots, because people didn't die of fright, as you say. No one was killed or that we know of anyway committed suicide because of this radio mm-hmm. story. But we like this idea that the world is full of these sheep.
Yeah,
why is that, do you think?
I think there's more than one reason. I always hate to reduce things to just one explanation. Yeah. I think one reason why it has persisted to this day is because it's easier to sort of imagine, well, I wouldn't have done that. Look at those old people mm-hmm. in the old days, easily misled by – I mean, it's like those old urban legend about at the beginning of movies that people would see the train rushing towards the screen and run out of the way because they somehow thought this was really a train, which actually I think Hugo, the Scorsese movie, actually put that whole untrue story on screen as something that really – as though it really happened.
Yeah.
So there's that. But beyond that, I think it also speaks to this, anxiety about the masses. I mean, the whole concept of quote unquote the masses. Mm-hmm. It speaks to what I describe in the book as enemy below stories. Mm-hmm. This notion that there are people who are in some sense, politically, economically, culturally below you on the social ladder. That can just turn into a horde of ravenous zombies and perhaps be directed by some master manipulator behind the scenes.
One of the things you talk about, of course, is that there are a lot of us who believe this stuff. And you mentioned mm-hmm. some of the polling. 36% who believe it's possible that the United States or leaders were somehow involved in 9/11 or they allowed it to happen. 36%. Mm-hmm. 61% of the country believes it was more than just Lee Harvey Oswald who mm-hmm. killed President Kennedy. We're going to come back to that. Yeah. A little bit later, because you've written about the fact that that number goes up and then lately seems to be coming down. But putting that aside, 71% of the country thinks the government is hiding something about UFOs, for mm-hmm. example. So there are a lot of us, I guess, who believe some form of some kind of conspiracy on some level, I guess.
Yeah, and again, since there are some real conspiracies, people conspire out
yeah.
there. It's natural that people are going to. I mean, I mentioned this in the book, that UFO number, the covering up something about UFOs. That doesn't necessarily mean that many people believe there are alien bodies
right.
being concealed in Roswell. They could believe, for example, that there was a weapons test, and they didn't want to say what it was, and so they covered it up. And the people who viewed it thought it was a UFO. That's not an insane. Thesis. But it's very popular, the idea of conspiracies. And it's important to stress this because so much of the discussion, I mean, this goes back all the way to the famous Richard Hofstadter essay, which actually the 50th anniversary of that is tomorrow, his original lecture.
Wow.
The day before the Kennedy assassination. It sounds like a strange coincidence. Maybe something more. But he says it's the paranoid style, as he calls it, is the preferred style only of minority movements.
Yeah.
And that's not true at all.
Right.
Often, a movement that's dominating politically can help. One way that it can sort of congeal itself around, the banners to talk about, them, the people that are opposed to you. And often that sort of rhetoric takes on a conspiratorial flavor.
Mm. But he really marginalized a paranoia in some ways, suggested these movements were small or were modest. But his mm-hmm. theories persist, 50 years on.
Yeah, no, and in fact, when we're talking about Kennedy theories persisting, I mean, there's a one non-conspiracy theory, but I think rather paranoid in its own way theory is the sort of Dallas did it idea. And
yeah.
you've seen, Frank Rich had an essay to this effect a couple of years ago in New York Magazine. There was a piece in the Times this week, which was a little more modestly put. But this is an idea that, right after the assassination, people looked at this kind of atmosphere of hate, quote unquote, and because of all the, you know, far right people in Dallas who hated John F. Kennedy, you know, and, you know, John Birch Society stronghold and so on. And there is this idea that, you know, Oswald was soaking in this and he soaked up, you know, this kind of hatred. And that's why Kennedy was killed there, which, of course, doesn't track with Oswald's own beliefs at all. I mean, he tried to kill or had been planning to kill a prominent Bircher just, you know, a few months before the Kennedy killing. So, I mean, it doesn't track the, you know, the known facts of the case at all. But I think it persists for the same reason that, you know, that sort of idea that Hofstadter was playing with persists. You know, I mean, it's and for that matter, it's very similar to the reason why the Orson Welles fable persists. I mean, you can sort of look at, you know, this sort of vague, differentiated mass of people and imagine that their frame of mind in some way led to a great national tragedy.
Jesse Walker is with us. His book is called United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. And you can join us if you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, as we approach the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy, it gives us an opportunity to talk about conspiracy stories, stuff like 9/11 being an inside job, the moon landing being faked, and they're easy to dismiss these ideas as coming from a small fringe of nut jobs. But the journalist Jesse Walker says, not so fast. He's here to explain how political paranoia itself, is a force that's always been a part of our history as a country. And he says there are believers on all sides of the political spectrum. His book is called The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You write about sort of the earliest history of these kinds of theories, and you begin with the Christian settlers who come to this new world, and they arrive here, and they kind of pretty quickly identify this dark force battling against them. And this is Satan, as you point out in the book. They figure Satan sort of gets here before they do. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, the story was that Satan, you know, drew a colony out of the remaining pagans in Europe as you know, the gospel spread through the old world. He came to the new world, brought these, you know, unconverted pagans with him, set them up as the Indians, and was basically sort of directing their attacks on the Puritans, you know, from the quote that I use in there is that they were actuated by the angel of the bottomless pit. And so there is this idea of sort of a vast Indian conspiracy being manipulated by the devil himself.
And the Indians, the natives, they're the devil's pawns.
Right.
And there's this theory that emerges, this captivity narrative.
Yeah, well, this is, this was a very popular genre of writing, the Indian captivity narrative, which was, you know, accounts by settlers who had been held prisoner by the natives. Right. I mean, this is, you know, based on, you know, actual events. It's not far out like, you know, the Indian, the Satan story. But it... And I draw on Richard Slotkin's work. He's a literary historian in describing this. They conform to a particular generic sort of structure, and the sort of underlying anxiety that comes through them is this idea that you will be Indianized, made un-English by your captivity, and often there's a sort of sexual anxiety of being, you know, raped by the Indian or being forced to, you know, partake of cannibal rituals or some such. And this is, you know, an idea that keeps coming back in American, you know, popular culture and conspiracy theories since then. I mean, often not with the captivity of the Indians, but, you know, other forms of captivity. You know, everything from Jay Hoberman once pointed out that it's interesting that The Searchers, the movie The Searchers, which is one of the classic, you know, modern captivity narratives, came out the same year as The Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Wow.
There really is sort of an interesting parallel between those two sorts of stories.
So that, you know, you write about, so this is kind of the enemy outside.
Yeah.
And you write about the witchcraft hysteria in New England. Which is kind of a twist on this form. This is the enemy next door.
Within. Yeah, the enemy within. Yeah, I mean, I should just say at the beginning, I identify sort of five primal narratives that keep recurring again and again, and they are the enemy outside, the enemy within, the enemy above, the enemy below, and the benevolent conspiracy. And sort of the twist on, you know, between the enemy outside and the enemy within is that the enemy outside. I mean, a classic example of the enemy outside, you know, being the fear of an Indian conspiracy, is some sort of alien force outside the community's gates that's trying to transform you into something radically different. But it's distinctly alien and it's distinctly out in the wilderness. The enemy within, it looks like you. You know, it could be your own neighbor, your own coworker, your own family. Anyone could be or could become. A part of, you know, the foe. And, you know, the classic example in American history that everyone knows is the Salem witch trials. The classic example of pop culture is what I mentioned earlier, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And even though this is sort of the opposite of the enemy outside, there are natural links between them. I mean, Cotton Mather, you know, the very prominent Puritan at the time of the witch trials, you know, was theorizing that perhaps, you know, the Indians were using, you know, black magic to direct these, you know, witchcraft attacks on the people of Satan. I mean, the people of Salem. And there's a quote in here that at their chief witch meetings, there has been present some French Canadians and some Indian Sagamores to concert the methods of ruining New England. So I identify these five stories, but they're always flowing in and out of one another. And frequently, especially with the enemy within and the enemy below, it is often the case that the enemy outside or the enemy above is imagined as ultimately acting behind the curtain, manipulating their efforts.
You write about the Second Great Awakening, this period in the 19th century, this time of religious revival in the country. It inspires this paranoid reaction, too. And that, of course, leads, since we're in Salt Lake, it's good to sort of, I suppose, raise this question of the Mormons, because you write about how Joseph Smith, you know, as soon as he, you know, creates this church, Mormonism, almost from the beginning, you say there were Mormon conspiracies.
Yeah, or, I mean, the fear of Mormon conspiracies was like a big current in 19th century America. Including, actually not just America, I mean, the first Sherlock Holmes story, you know, had a Mormon conspiracy at the core of it because, you know, Arthur couldn't, and in fact, he later apologized for that. He came to Utah and spoke and said, I had been misinformed about, you know, what your church was doing. But yeah, I mean, it's a lot of the Mormon conspiracy theories sort of took old anti-Catholic conspiracy theories and sort of retrofitted them for a different faith so that first Joseph Smith and then Brigham Young are imagined as sort of an all-powerful pope of a cult and their followers are docile sheep. But then it takes on these distinct flavorings with that are specific to, you know, the fear of Mormons. The idea that converts were either, you know, kidnapped and compelled to join, you know, these vast Mormon harems, or that they were sort of compelled through some sort of mind control or mesmerism to become Mormons. There are stories written about supposed secret lodges of women who were there to service church officials, a lot of sexual projection, you know, on the parts of the people who are, you know, not Mormons, but said, well, here's a sect that has a different family structure. I'm going to project all the things that they might be up to and complain about that. And also, you know, a fear of, you know, Mormons, you know, acting. And this kind of gets back to what we were saying about, you know, the people in the streets following Orson Welles' will, acting en masse to subvert American democracy. And, you know, their movements to prevent Mormons from having the access to the ballot, access to juries. I mean, Idaho, in its territorial days, passed some pretty severe restrictions on Mormon civil liberties, and largely based on these conspiracy theories.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's
I didn't even mention the Danites.
The Danites. You got to mention the Danite assassins.
Oh, yeah. I can't believe I left that out. You know, the fear of, like, secret Mormon assassination squads. If I mention the mind control, I got to mention the assassins, too. Right?
Well, I have to say, I think that, and we've done programs about some of these ideas, and I think the Danite assassin theories, I'm not sure nationwide, but you still hear them in Utah, these ideas. And some are connected to some truth. There's some concern about whether Brigham Young, for example, had ordered some of these assassinations. So there's always a kernel of something in there. But it's interesting how they do persist in the West.
Yeah. No, and I should say, I talk about some places where the evidence is ambiguous. You know, I mean, there's William Wild Bill Hickman, not to be confused with Wild Bill Hickok. There were a few different Wild Bills running around back then, writing a memoir where he claimed that he had carried out assassinations on Young's orders, and different historians disagree on how seriously you should take this particular narrative. But there are areas of ambiguity, and then there's areas of obvious fantasy, and I wander through both of them in the book.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Alan is with us in Provo, Utah. Alan, hi.
Hi, Doug. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I just wanted to make a quick sort of comment and question. Here, getting back to Utah, we have here somebody who is, there was a book recently published that's trying to kind of resurface the satanic panic of the 1980s. And I'm just, and a lot of people get drawn into this and all this hysteria happens. And I personally think it's kind of sad and it's kind of harmful. And so what do you say? I mean, as fascinating as it is to study all this, how do you combat it? You know, how do you kind of inject a little reason into this discourse? Or is that even possible?
Well, that's a good question. Jesse Walker, put that question aside for just a second, and let's sort of flesh out what he's talking about. Because you do write about this. You made a reference to it earlier, this idea of a moral panic, this idea of there being this kind of the folk devil, this all this business of satanic worship in rock and roll, in this idea in the 60s and 70s about there being backmasking in the music, all these satanic references. You want to talk about that component first, sort of put that in historical context, and then we can get to whether or not there's anything to do about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Satan scare, now, when you're talking about the period of it, there's two different things to talk about because, of course, on the, conservative Christian circles, this has been ongoing.
Right.
And I discuss in particular in detail about, someone who was riding the circuit in the 1970s claiming to be a former Satanist, a former member of the Illuminati. Talking about, the grand plan that was going to lead to the apocalypse in just a few short years, especially after the Antichrist Jimmy Carter took office.
Right.
But then in the 1980s and early 90s, a lot of this, not the bit about Jimmy Carter as the literal Antichrist, but a lot of it enters the mainstream. And I think there's when I say the mainstream, I mean you have people going to jail on very thin evidence of allegedly participating in these crimes. You have serious news programs like 2020 doing very shoddy sort of recapitulations of the alleged evidence for satanic conspiracies or satanic ritual abuse, and not interviewing any skeptical voices at all, or at least not putting them on the air. So I think that you had basically three secular scares that kind of conjoined with one another in the mainstream, so that people were able then to absorb these ideas that sort of came out of what had been on the fringe. One was, the sudden interest in missing children, which sort of began with some high-profile murders and kidnappings. You had the Atlanta child killings from 79 to 81. You had Eaton Patz, Adam Walsh. And, people may remember all the the milk carton faces. You know, I mean, there's this great intense interest in missing children then, a lot of which, you know, wound up there were dubious statistics going around, so that an article might lead with in the mainstream media might lead with a story about a horrific kidnapping and murder, and then offer statistics of how many missing children there are that doesn't mention that the vast majority of these kids were taken by parents in custodial disputes or had run away or returned home within 24 hours. So there's this category confusion. The second scare was the surge in charges of child molestation, because up until like 1970s, this had frequently been swept under the rug and people had sort of ignored the crime or not treated it very seriously. And there was this kind of reaction against that, which unfortunately swung too far in the other direction, because a lot of people were charged on, you know, very dubious evidence, often, you know, like a sketchy therapist putting someone under hypnosis and claiming, you know, memories had been recovered and that sort of thing. And then third, you had the cult scare, mm-hmm. you know, and we've just had the anniversary of Jonestown. Yeah. So people might remember that was in the air at that time, too. So when you have this idea of, you know, missing kids, kids being molested, and cults operating, and then you have this sort of pre-existing mythology that had been circulating in this particular part of the Christian world, it became this, you know, they all mixed together. And then in the 1980s, you know, you had the situation that the caller was addressing.
Mm-hmm. Alan, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Paul is with us in Brigham City. Paul, welcome.
Thank you. Excuse me. I wanted to ask about some of the purveyors of these conspiracy theories who, in my mind, profit from continuing or advocating these conspiracy theories, and maybe if you could comment on your experience, do they actually believe this stuff? I mean, Alex Jones comes to mind, but there are others probably.
Yeah. You write about Alex Jones in your book, Jesse Walker.
Yeah, he comes up in passing. I mean, the answer for how much someone believes of what they say obviously varies from figure to figure. I mean, I mentioned the guy I said who was traveling the circuit in the 1970s, his name was John Todd. He was a con man, and yet at the same time, he was a bit of a crazy man. And I'm not absolutely convinced that he never believed anything he said, even as he spun all these wild and contradictory stories. But he was, you know, ultimately a con man. Other people clearly are very sincere. And then you've got this middle territory, because the thing about Alex Jones is there's this definitely a self-aware performative mm-hmm. quality to what he does. You know, I mean, he's aware that there is a character, Alex Jones, who he is playing.
Right.
That doesn't mean he doesn't believe what he says. I think that's typical of, you know, people in the media, whether you're, Rush Limbaugh, Rachel Maddow, whoever, just because you're playing a character doesn't mean you're being Stephen Colbert and playing a character that you don't like, right?
Right.
And so Alex Jones, I mean, I think that he, I think he's sincere, but I also think he knows what it is just to sort of flip a switch and turn on the Alex Jones rant. And his worldview is very interesting, because he's, a lot of it comes out of the far right. Other parts come. There's elements that come elsewhere in the political spectrum, and some bits that aren't really political. I mean, if you've ever seen, you can go Google this if you want to entertain yourself, him ranting about Justin Bieber. To me, it resembles nothing more than, you know, the punk rock kid who's like, they're just trying to fill our head with this corporate rock junk, man. You know, it's very, our corporate pop, you know. So it's an interesting mixture, and I think he's attuned to something there. I should also say, I saw him interviewing Mike Judge, who also lives in Austin, like Alex Jones, and of course was the creator of King of the Hill. Yeah. And the subject of Dale Gribble came up, the conspiracy theorist,
right,
character, you know, who, you know, who believes every conspiracy except the one in front of his face that his wife is having an affair.
Right.
What's his name? Judge was just sort of chuckling, like, yeah, I guess I made you guys look pretty bad with that. But it was clear that he and Jones, you know, kind of socialized together a bit, too, around Austin. So
wow.
I think Jones has, some sense of humor about what he's doing, even if he believes all of it.
Well, and throughout the book, you talk about also how this cuts both ways, that, you know, it's wrong to suggest paranoia comes from the fringe, or that these concepts you know, apply just to the right end of the political spectrum. And I wonder if you think that liberals, which is maybe oversimplifying a term, but let me just use it to illustrate my question. Sure. Have liberals created their own boogeyman with the radical right? You know, the same sense of hysteria there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not that the left and the right, one is more prone to conspiracy theories than the other, you know, en masse. I mean, there are particular factions. We'll say, all right, the LaRouches, they've got more conspiracy theories than most people. It's more about the direction of the conspiracy fears. And especially if you look a little bit broader than just conspiracy and just, you know, the capacity for something like a moral panic. To the extent that we have good data and you know, it's questionable how much we do, but it's at the same time in, you know, 2009 and 2010 that there are all these stories about rising right-wing violence. You know, the most complete account I've seen of how many violent right-wing incidents there were per year, it was actually going down each of those years, but it was a narrative that was appealing to people and which sort of fed people's anxieties about, you know, opposition to, you know, finally you've got a president in office that you're supporting and people are opposing it. So I think absolutely. And then of course, when Occupy happened, you know, flipped around on the other side. It's not just that there were some conspiracy theories about Occupy on the right, although there were people claiming George Soros was behind it and other such nonsense, but just also some of this sort of vague, you know, dread that, you know, something was bubbling out there.
Jesse Walker is with us. His book is The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. And you can join the conversation. Paul, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Jesse Walker. We're talking about his book, The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I want to ask you about this kind of ironic twist on the story. It's this, the rise of this kind of style of paranoia that kind of has a sense of humor, less interested in believing conspiracy theories, is kind of playing with them, is how you put it. Mm-hmm. You write about this. There are a number of these kinds of groups of pranksters, but talk about the Discordians.
Yeah, and this is the chapter whose name I can't say on the radio.
Right, Mind Blank, yeah.
Yeah, right, but they had what we will call Operation Mind Blank for the purposes of this conversation. And they were deliberately, I mean, I should say, first of all, the Discordians sort of began in the late 50s and sort of by a couple of high school wiseacres who were just sort of making a fake religion dedicated to the worship of Eris, the Greek goddess of chaos. And they sort of revived the idea when they're a bit older in the 1960s and got some other people involved. And Operation Mind Blank was this this sort of performance art piece slash prank slash political protest, where they were planting stories in the underground press and various left wing and libertarian outlets that they had access to, with various conspiracy fantasies, often starring the Illuminati, which before at that point was mostly a far right concern. But suddenly you might have a Chicago underground paper having daily linked to Illuminati, you know, as its banner headline, and this was the pranksters had done that, you know. Sending letters to various people, including various conspiracy theorists, trying to, you know, they sent the letter to the head of the John Birch Society, telling them that, you know, we're the Illuminati. We want you to let you know this star writer of yours is one of us. There was, after Jim Garrison, the New Orleans DA, who was chasing, JFK conspiracies down in New Orleans, the subject of the famous Oliver Stone film. Yep. After he failed to, you know, convict one of the people he was after, One of the Discordians sent a letter to one of Garrison's big boosters in the Los Angeles Underground Press saying that the reason why it had failed was because the jury was stacked with Illuminati members, and you could tell they were all in the Illuminati because none of them had a left nipple. So just a bizarre sense of humor. But a lot of this wound up injecting the Illuminati into sort of mass popular culture again. And I mean, not just this, but some follow-ups. I mean, a couple of the people involved in this, Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea, wrote Illuminatus, which is a trilogy now available in one volume, which is sort of a very funny cult novel published in the mid-70s that played with these ideas. And it's just sort of a classic example of the ironic style of political paranoia. People were saying, like, let's create a mythology and maybe just do something for laughs, maybe as when Illuminatus, you know, do something a bit more substantial, you know, that, I mean, substantial as satire, because there's a lot of social commentary in that book. But not get caught up in sort of like what I'm doing, not get caught up in debunking or espousing something we really believe, but just playing with these ideas.
Yeah. Just having fun with it. I mean, you mentioned the magazine The Realist, which is this is Paul Krasner, who writes this. And this is, you describe as kind of one of the most infamous hoaxes of the 1960s. It's this book, which is titled The Parts That Were Left Out of the Kennedy Book.
Right. It was an article. It was called
Article. Talk about that, because that's kind of funny.
Boy,
can I
discuss that on the air?
That's only parts of it. I think you can refer to the very creepy illusion in there if you want.
Yeah. William Manchester had written The Death of a President, which was a best-selling book about Kennedy's assassination, you know, recreating what happened and so on. And then Paul Krasner wrote The Parts That Were Left Out of the Kennedy Book, which was supposed to be the bits that landed on the cutting room floor. And he started out, I mean, when I interviewed Paul, he described it as a seduction. He begins with some stories that were known to be true but hadn't been widely reported, stuff like, you know, Kennedy's affairs and so on. And then he starts inventing things and making them steadily less plausible, so that he ends with this story of LBJ having sexual congress with the president's throat wound. Yeah. And there was a little notation at the end, you know, this is the bit of the conspiracy bit that, you know, maybe he was trying to change the entry wound into an exit wound by enlarging it. And there was a lot of people believed this, which, you know, maybe speaks to people's gullibility, but also speaks to how unpopular LBJ was in certain circles. So Daniel Ellsberg, you know, met Paul Krasner and confessed, you know, when he read that, he believed it. He said, maybe it was just because I wanted to believe it so badly. So Krasner wrote a lot of what he called investigative satires, where he would do the actual reporting of investigative journalism, but sort of then see how he could insert, you know, fictional things into it as well and create these sort of ironic conspiracy narratives. And Robert Anton Wilson, who wrote Illuminatus, was a columnist for The Realist. So, you know, a lot of these people, and Krasner was on the distribution list for Wilson's memo laying out how Operation Mind Blank would proceed. I'm going to slip eventually, and you're going to want to be on the air again.
I'll be good, right?
There's a lot of connections among these pranksters as well.
It's interesting the tone that changes in American popular culture about after Watergate, for example. And there's this you've talked about, for example, you contrast the episode of the television show, the kind of doofy 60s show, My Three Sons, with this episode of the show Good Times, which is a 70s sitcom. One has a kind of lightheartedness about it. And one is really, you know, one version, the Good Times version, is pretty somber, and that comes after Watergate. Say something about that.
Yeah, I mean, well, these were both, I mean, both the Good Times episode and the My Three Sons episode were stories about an ordinary American family falling under federal surveillance. But they're very different. Yeah. The My Three Sons episode, you know, which for those of you who haven't seen the show, you know, Fred McMurray and his his wife is dead, and he's raising three children on his own. He's an aeronautical engineer, And he's under surveillance because he's working on a top secret project, and the government doesn't want anything to leak out. And so we have all these sort of lighthearted episodes where, you know, the agents, you know, who are tapping their phone and following them around have to file reports on these incredibly banal things. And it's all it feels, if you watch it, you know, with this post-Watergate mentality, it is horrifying that this is presented as, you know, the way it's presented, especially at the end when the father turns, breaks the fourth wall, talks to the audience directly, says, you know, now the project is completed. I can tell you what it was about. You see, I was working on a type of missile. And then the word top secret appears on the screen and everything gets scrambled. And it feels like, you know, the national security state has just invaded your home, and you too are under this the watchful eye of the feds. But in it's played for as a joke. The laugh track goes off. Now, with the Good Times episode, you know, we have the dad losing his job. I guess what happens at the beginning is that one of the children sends a letter to the government of Cuba asking for some information, and not for subversive reasons, but because it has to do with a school paper he's writing related to the bicentennial. He wanted to contrast the good American Revolution with the bad Cuban Revolution. But because he wrote to, you know, a hostile government, the FBI starts nosing around, asking questions, and because, you know, the dad's boss doesn't want to have trouble with the government, he just lets the guy go, even though he doesn't do anything wrong. And it's this real. This comes out in 1976. It's, you know, right after, you know, the Church Committee and all these revelations about CIA and FBI, you know, covert operations and surveillance and interference with, you know, nonviolent dissident groups. And it too ends with the father looking straight at the camera, and he says, you know something, I've got the feeling that somewhere, someplace, my name is still in somebody's file. And there's no laugh track this time. It's there's no question that this is considered, you know, a really bad thing.
I wanted to ask you about, it's interesting, well, the further away we got from the Kennedy assassination, the more people, for a time, believed it, you know, that that was the result of some kind of conspiracy. But now that number is kind of dropping, and you've written about this recently, and you have identified these kind of two questions at stake: why these JFK theories have been so popular and why they're becoming less popular. And I wanted to ask you about that, because you've written that something larger than just looking at the evidence is going on here, and that something is the mark that President Kennedy's death left on the country's psychic landscape, is how you put it. Explain that, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, you can't just say, well, everybody read a whole bunch of JFK conspiracy books and were convinced, and then in the last 10 years, suddenly a lot of the country has been convinced by the anti-conspiracy books. I don't think that's a plausible explanation. Right. But it's interesting to explore, number one, why the Kennedy assassination looms large in a way that other high-profile crimes that left some open questions did not, you know? I mean, I don't think it's just the fact that this was a president, you know? I think it's the fact that the Kennedy assassination, you know, was the opening shots, and I should probably find a better metaphor than that to use, of, you know, the 60s. You know, it's followed by these other assassinations, by riots, by the Vietnam War, by all sorts of events ranging from, you know, the Nixon crimes, Watergate, you know, to the Jonestown Massacre. You basically have almost two decade period of one thing battering the country after another. And thinking about who was responsible for the Kennedy assassination, or even just beyond it, thinking about Kennedy not being assassinated is a way of thinking about things being different. And thinking about who might be responsible is, among other things, a way of thinking about who might have wanted things to go differently. Yeah. So, but the intensity of memory is fading.
Yep.
I think that it's not a purely generational thing. I think it's just that as we as a culture move farther and farther away from that period of 63 through about 81 or so, that drive to explain it, that drive to look for the evidence in the first place, starts to fade. So that's my working thesis anyway.
And you're sticking to it.
Yeah. Well, until someone gives me a better one.
Right, right. It's interesting that You write about the right-wing conspiracy theory that President Obama, for example, wasn't born in this country, born in Kenya. So we don't have a lot of time to talk about this. You kind of work through some of this. What do you think that these birther conspiracies, what do they reveal, do you think?
Well, I identify sort of three motives that are kind of lurking behind them, or at least three motives. And I'm not saying everyone who's a birther subscribes to all three of these, but there is overlap and so on. One is just the desire for some sort of magic bullet that could eliminate a figurative bullet that could eliminate a political foe without the pain of political persuasion. It's worth noting that, I mean, you said right-wing birther theories, but it actually first emerged among hardcore supporters of Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And one of the first conspiracy theorists, you know, to promote the idea was very much on the left. Then when it – because, you know, Clinton was losing to Obama and there was this, you know, felt need to get – you know, somehow take him off the stage. And then when it becomes Obama versus McCain, that's when the theory drifts to the right. Then beyond that, though, I think there's a fear of the foreign. I think that someone who looks at Obama's, you know, very different from other presidents' background, not just in the sense of being half black, but you know having part of his childhood in Indonesia, you know, even just being from Hawaii, you know, the one American state that isn't in the Americas. A lot of people that person is already metaphorically foreign, and conspiracy theories are very good at making the metaphoric concrete, you know. And then third of all, there's this. If you're someone who admires the presidency but doesn't admire the president, and I think that's true of a lot of people on the right in particular, though there's some liberals like that as well, you're naturally drawn towards something that allows you to say that person isn't really president, that person is illegitimate. Mm-hmm. And often in a lot of the birther literature, you get almost royalist metaphors saying pretender to the throne, that sort of thing. And it's not because, you know, they're secretly monarchists. It's because it's that whole sort of how do you admire the office while rejecting, you know, the person who's occupying it. So I think those are the three things I write about in connection with birtherism.
I think finally here, maybe we should come back to the second part of our earlier caller, Alan's question, which is kind of frustration of, come on, Jesse Walker, what can you do about this? Do you get that question from time to time? I guess this.
Yeah, from time to time, and I don't have a very satisfying answer for people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I will say there are stories that are. I mean, there are conspiracy theorists who are very actually open to evidence, and there are some who just love to dig in their heels, and anything that contradicts what they believe is just considered part of the cover up and not to be credited. But with the first group, you can certainly debate, and as long as it's a conspiracy theory that is not completely – I mean, when you're dealing with someone who thinks the president is a lizard man from outer space, I think you've kind of the ship of rational persuasion has sailed. But that's not necessarily the case with other stories.
Jesse Walker, managing editor of Reason Magazine, author of the book The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory, joined us today from NPR member station WYPR in Baltimore. Jesse Walker, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our theme music, composed by The Moth and the Flame, thanks to Taylor Almond. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.